This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, fighting for financial security for our seniors. Find out more at carp.ca.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Zoomer Week in Review. All things Zoomer worldwide. I'm Libby Znaimer. Are we too fearful of cancer? A new book argues our fear is out of date and excessive. And how a runaway child from Chennai, India, rose to become a celebrity chef in Toronto. I'll talk to Sash Simpson about his rags-to-riches story. But first, here are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. There are plans for defibrillators to be delivered to patients by drones in Wales to make sure that people in rural areas have access. Test flights are underway, and health experts say this method could be the difference between life and death. Defibrillators are used to give the best chance of survival after cardiac arrest, and more than 6,000 people have a cardiac arrest in Wales every year. Sweden has a similar initiative, and in a world first, the drone program is credited with saving the life of a man who suffered a heart attack. The company responsible for a global recall of sleep apnea machines has reached a settlement with the U.S. government. Philips must overhaul its manufacturing and systems before it can resume production at its U.S. facilities. The settlement also requires the company to hire independent experts after 5 million machines were recalled because their internal foam can break down, causing users to inhale tiny particles of fumes while they sleep.
Quite a big moment because we've never changed the sovereign on the banknotes because the Queen was the first sovereign to be on the banknote.
This week, King Charles was shown new banknotes that feature his image. The governor of the Bank of England visited the King at Buckingham Palace to present the notes. The governor told the King this is a big moment as before him, only his mother, Queen Elizabeth, had appeared on British currency. The man who saved Cardiff City Hall in the UK from World War II bombs is 100 years old this week. Ronald Brignall was 16 years old when he saved the building after a bomb fell by clamping a sandbag between his teeth and climbing a drain pipe. He was cheered on by official fire watchers as he went back up with a fire hose to finish putting out the fire. Cardiff's mayor traveled to Brignall's nursing home in West Sussex this week to present him with a special certificate thanking him for his heroism. Nobel Prize-winning physicist Peter Higgs has died following a short illness at the age of 94. He proposed the existence of the so-called God particle that helped explain how matter formed after the Big Bang. Higgs predicted the existence of a new particle, which came to be known as the Higgs boson, in 1964. His work helped scientists understand one of the most fundamental riddles of the universe, how the Big Bang created something out of nothing 13.8 billion years ago. I'm Libby Znaimer, and those are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. April is Daffodil Month, a time devoted to raising awareness about cancer. The all-consuming fear of it is still with us, even though survival rates have skyrocketed. Author David Ropeek argues that this fear is also harming us. I talked with him about curing cancer phobia, how risk, fear and worry mislead us.
The psychology suggests that a risk we have no control over is much more frightening, and a risk that kills us in a very painful way is much more frightening. And I would say those two factors are probably what makes cancer a scarier thing than, say, heart disease, which we have some control over and kills us in a less painful way, but it's more likely to kill us.
There are so many new treatments for so many different kinds of cancer in a lot of ways, and for many types of cancer, it's becoming a chronic disease. Has that just not penetrated the public consciousness?
No, I don't think the progress has penetrated the consciousness. Most surveys show that most people still think the word cancer means death, and it doesn't anymore. And that's why our fear, I think, in that case, exceeds the risk and gets us into trouble. And because we've had the promise of the cure, it's been framed in people's minds that way. And so when there is incremental progress, as there has been, goodness, you have had that experience yourself, it doesn't register against how we've come to think about it. That's still stuck in our brains.
The first thing you talk about in terms of individuals, the dangers of this, overscreening, overdiagnosis, and overtreatment. Let's talk about that.
We believe in screening deeply, and the screening world has advocated screening, and its benefits. And there are benefits. It turns out they're more modest, if you look at the statistics, than we commonly believe. Mammography, for example, forgive me, I know U.S. statistics, saves 2 women per 1,000 screened over 10 years. That saved women, but it's pretty modest. And what the screening advocates don't tell us at all, and I believe this to be a dishonesty, is that screening has harms. Screening has harms from false positives. 1 in 8 women in the United States over 10 years will be told you have cancer, you might have cancer, and then find out later you don't. That's awful. And then, of course, that leads to the other two issues that you talked about, over diagnosis and over treatment. So screening's really good at finding little small early cancers, which we've been led to believe that's when they're more treatable. And that's true. But there's a larger pool of them out there than there is the fast growing ones. So screening's just going to find more of these little ones. And we've learned that a lot of the little ones never go on to cause any harm. But when people are told they have those cancers, even when the doctor says they'll never harm you, guess what most people say? Ah, it's cancer. Cut it out.
Back to breast cancer. In the case of a DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ, which some don't even classify as a cancer, the issue is, yeah, some of them will never cause harm, but we don't really know which ones will and which ones won't.
Well, this is a challenge. But it turns out if one looks even more closely at the medical literature, there's low, medium, and high-grade DCIS. And there are things about the cells, looking at them under the microscope, that can tell us this is more likely or less likely to spread. So there is a way, like there is with prostate cancer, with the Gleason score, where they look at the cells and they say this is more likely to be fast or slow growing. That's biological evidence. It's no guarantee, though. And we're so afraid of cancer that the breast cancer community in particular says we can't tell women not to have surgery and just do active surveillance or watchful waiting, as they can tell with men with prostate cancer, because we don't want to not scare women into doing everything they can to have the possible cancer that might spread removed.
I remember that when Angelina Jolie disclosed her double mastectomy, and she has a very virulent genetic mutation, BRCA1 she's got, there was a rash of women looking for double mastectomies, even if they didn't have this mutation, and including people I know. And I mean, I kept scratching my head saying, you know, double mastectomy is not a treatment for anxiety.
It's the C word. It's the fear. There you go. I mean, and that's one example of many. Even the women who are diagnosed with high-grade DCIS, who choose to have a double mastectomy in the other breast that isn't affected, are told by their doctors, there is absolutely no clinical benefit to removing the other breast. None. And they do it anyway because of fear. That's why in the book I call these surgeries fear-ectomies.
What about underdiagnosis and undertreatment because of fear?
Gosh, there were several papers that have recently come out. 2 people in 5 in England said, if I had symptoms that could be cancer, I wouldn't go to the doctor because I would be afraid of being told that's what I have. 1 in 4 said, I would wait and see if the symptoms went away. And there are a number of people, and I cite them in the book, who, when they have symptoms that could be cancer, that really look clearly to be cancer, I don't want to know. I don't want to hear it. One of them, by the way, I tell the story in the book, is the former head of the National Cancer Institute in the United States, who had an enlarged prostate. He knows that could either just be an enlarged prostate because he was an older white male, or it could be prostate cancer. And he put off going to the doctor because he was afraid of the C word. This was the former head of the National Cancer Institute. He knew that lots of prostate cancers are treatable. He didn't want to hear the diagnosis. A patient that gets all this information still has to weigh all that information, which is abstract, versus the visceral animal protect me, keep me alive fear that's associated with the word cancer. And a lot of people suffer for that fear.
Okay, we'll wrap it up on that note. David Ropeik, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. That was author David Ropeik. His book is Curing Cancer Phobia. I'm Libby Znaimer, and this is the Zoomer Week in Review. Coming up, the story of a local celebrity chef who started life as a runaway on the streets of Chennai, India.
You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, bringing you vital information to boost your health, your finances, and your rights. Find out more at carp.ca.
I remember jumping on trains, eating out of the garbage cans, begging, stealing, whatever I can do to eat and survive. And one day, a miracle happened to me.
That's a clip from Born Hungry, the real-life rags-to-riches tale of Sash Simpson, a runaway child from the streets of India who was adopted into a Toronto family with 31 siblings before becoming a world-renowned chef.
My mom has an orphanage in India. Her name is Sandra Simpson, and she has families for children. She has, you know, she had many of them around the world. And the one I came out of was in India, in Chennai. She had so many people working for her and wandering the streets, taking kids off the streets, and kids like me that didn't have a home, that was a runaway. And it just happened to be working out for me when I was at the right place at the right time. And I got picked up. So when they told me this story, listen, we have an orphanage. You can be in it. And there's three meals a day and you can go to school. You can get adopted and to America, Canada kind of deal. I'm like, I was, you know, I took it because it sounded so good. And I wanted a family and needed to be somewhere other than living on the streets, begging and eating out of garbage cans. Everything just lined for me at that moment, and it never looked back.
How did you get to Canada?
My mom, which is Sandra, she used to come to the orphanage, and the buzz around the orphanage was "Mummy is coming." And I've always said, "Who's Mummy?" And I was told, "She's the lady that takes care of us." So this tall blonde lady walks in, and I walk up to her and I pull her skirt and say, "Mummy, Mummy, Canada, Canada." Because that's what I was told when I got picked up off the street. And she just looked down on me. She goes and patted my head. She goes, "Yeah, yep, yep." And I did that probably three different times when she came. And one day I was taking a nap and I got woken up saying, "Get up, you're going to Canada."
Wow.
My eyes just lit up, and I walk outside and there was my sister, Kimberly. She goes, "Hi, my name is Kimberly Simpson. I'm your sister. I got to get you to Canada, and you're my mom's Christmas gift. So let's go."
You grew up in the household with the Simpsons. Were all the brothers and sisters adoptive? Tell me what.
When I got adopted and I came here, and then I start finding out there were like kids from around the globe. And my mom had four biological kids. And the rest, 28, were adopted. So total of 32. I came on a Christmas, 23rd of December, 1979. And all it was, came out of the airport, skinny kid, from India, and it was cold. It was like a blizzard. It was just beautiful. I never seen snow in my life and never felt so cold. And that, and you know, once I came to Canada, things started to turn.
When did you start cooking, and when did you know you wanted to be a chef?
First of all, I never wanted to be a chef. That wasn't my intentions at all. All I knew was I just wanted to work hard at whatever it was. But having so many kids in the family, in the house, it came to a point where I saw my mom traveling a lot. And, you know, I'm going to India, I'm going to El Salvador, I'm going to Bangladesh. And she went to all these orphanages that she had. And so, you know, we had to like cook at home. And then my mom, when she was home, she used to cook breakfast, lunch, dinner. And then to a point when we got older, we realized, you know what, we don't want mom to be cooking all the time. She'd been cooking forever. So let's take over. So we all took turns. My days were Wednesdays, and I did spaghetti because spaghetti is my favorite.
Did you end up going to culinary school or what?
Restaurant business or the hospitality started when my sister Melanie, she was a cocktail waitress at Pat Mario's at Yonge and Eglinton.
Not exactly gourmet, yeah.
No, but you know what? One day she said, listen, two of our dishwashers are going back to Jamaica and we have no dishwashers. We only have one. Would you like to give a hand? I'm like, 100%. So I went and did dishes. And that's when it started for me on the hospitality side of it. And, you know, I said, hey, I want to be a bar boy. I want to be a bus boy. I want to go into the kitchen. She said, nope, you're not going in the kitchen. I go, what are you talking about? I want to go in the kitchen. She goes, no, Sash, once you go into a kitchen, you'll never come out. And moving forward, and she was right.
What made you want to go back to India to try to find out where you come from? And how did that go?
An opportunity came to me about, I think, 15, 20 years ago. One of my clients, when I worked at Fine Dining Establishment in Toronto, North 44, we became friends, and he said, Sash, your story is insanely amazing. It needs to be told. You need to do a movie. And I just looked at a movie. I'm a streets kid from India. I got adopted to a Canadian family. All I'm trying to do is trying to craft my skill in this restaurant and see if I can get better and better. And then, you know what? After 15, 20 years later, I end up, you know, being a head chef of a restaurant that didn't want to hire me. Finally, they did. And I became their head chef for 18 years, been with the company for 25, opened up Bimark Restaurant, part of the group. And then I said, you know what, I need to do something else. And I opened up my own restaurant at Summerhill. And he came, that same client came, and his name was Jay Hennick. He came to my restaurant. He goes, you're doing a movie, like it or not. I'm sending directors in. And that's how the story came, and going back to India, trying to find my parents and see if I can put this puzzle together and about my life. And then the documentary premiered in Palm Springs of January of this year, and called Born Hungry. And Barry Average was the producer.
What do you want to leave us with?
Second chances are always available, and don't give up, and things will happen. When you get that opportunity, don't let it go. Just keep working hard at it.
Sash Simpson, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
That was Sash Simpson. Born Hungry will be screened at Hot Docs on April 26th. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the Zoomer Week in Review. I'm Libby Znaimer. Thanks for joining me today. Be sure to come back next week to stay up to date with all things Zoomer worldwide.
Zoomer Week in Review is produced by Zeev Hadi, Christine Ross, and Paul Thomas. With technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer Moses Znaimer.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.